This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to The State of Health, the podcast where patients put healthcare decision makers and thought leaders in the hot seat. I'm Gunnar Esiason. On today's Three Questions episode is Governor Mike Dunleavy from Alaska. The rule in a Three Questions episode is simple. The role of the interviewer will flip halfway through the show. Let's get to it. Governor Dunleavy, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Gunnar. Thanks for having me.
So early in the vaccine rollout, Alaska was a national leader, despite largely being a rural state. How did you achieve so much success with your rollout plan? And would you say that your rollout plan is a playbook for other rural parts of the world that are just starting their vaccination programs?
Boy, the last part's that's a good question, but let me address the first part of the question. So we in Alaska, we were hit pretty hard in 1918 by the Spanish flu. We lost more people in our Alaska Native population than anywhere else on the planet, maybe with the exception of Samoa. And when I came up here in the early 80s, I lived in rural Alaska for almost 20 years, small towns, small villages, hundreds of miles off the road. And I would have conversations with survivors of that Spanish flu era, in which their parents had passed away and they were sent into missions or orphanages or adopted out. These elders in the 1980s would talk about what happened. My own mother-in-law, my wife is from a very small village up north. She's an Eskimo lady. My own mother-in-law lost her father to the flu in the 20s. And so it was a real thing for me. And so we were the first state that received the first plane load of folks from Wuhan. They were State Department officials and their families in January of 2020. And we received them in our international airport at Ted Stevens International Airport. And we went on, we let them disembark in a abandoned part of our international terminal that was all set up for them. They were tested, et cetera, and sent on their way down to California to another Air Force base for further observation. But the long and short of it is, we knew that we were going to be somewhat on our own because we always are, just where we are geographically. We deal with earthquakes on a daily basis. Volcanic eruptions are common up here. Floods are common up here. Fires. So we deal with these disasters on a regular basis. So we have the parts of a team that we put together for, I think, what turned up to be actually a great pandemic response team. And so, as you noted, we had second lowest death numbers in the entire nation, just after Vermont, which has a smaller population than Alaska. And what we did is we protected our most vulnerable really quickly, our elders, our seniors, those with underlying health conditions. And so we protected them. And then when the vaccine rolled out, we were all set up and ready to go. And part of the reason is that we have a somewhat of an integrated health system here in Alaska with tribal health. We have the largest Native American population at 15% per capita here in Alaska. And so we have had these systems set up. And so we had somewhat of a decentralized distribution process where health clinics in communities and hospitals and larger communities were the ones that were distributing the vaccinations early on. We also worked collaboratively with them. We had our own teams. We'd go out where there might be some hotspots to help the local folks with dealing with the vaccination, dealing with the virus mitigation, et cetera. And so I do think there's some things that could be learned from Alaska. Like I said, we've got most of our state is roadless. It'll take you, it's a 1700 mile trip to go from Shimia in the Aleutians all the way up to Kaktovik on the Arctic Ocean. It's 1700 miles and you're still within the state of Alaska. So you can see that we've had to adjust to deal with distribution of vaccinations, but also, like I said, mitigation. So integration of our healthcare systems, collaboration and cooperation with our Indian healthcare systems, it really did well for Alaska. So right now we're pretty happy where we were, and we're looking forward to where we're going, as we would say.
So now what you talked about here is a lot of really great points with how well the vaccine rollout has gone in Alaska. But as with much of the country, some vaccine acceptance has started to wane. And even the, you know, the success that Alaska was seeing has started to regress near the U.S. averages in vaccine coverage after initially being way out in front. Does your state have plans to increase vaccine acceptance, or sort of, you know, work to increase vaccine acceptance before the colder months come on, when the traditional cold and flu season washes over the U.S. and some epidemiologists are predicting, you know, subsequent waves of COVID?
Yeah, so we're still putting a lot of effort into media communication, et cetera. There's some incentive programs that some of the local communities are using, especially in the areas that there's a low vaccination rate. Again, the important part is our most vulnerable have been protected, and thus our death rates and hospitalization rates are way down. That's obviously a good aspect of this. But I think what you're going to see over time is, unfortunately, some folks will get ill. They'll know some neighbors that got ill or some family members, and that will spur them to get the vaccination. But in the end, we continue to communicate with all Alaskans and those that have yet to get the vaccination. We're using a lot of our media approaches, as well as some incentives. So we'll see where that goes. I think we're approaching, we're heading towards 60%. And as you mentioned, we got out pretty fast early on and took care of our most vulnerable, but we're still working on this to communicate with those that may be a little hesitant to get the vaccination.
The State of Health, we'll be right back. Now, away from the vaccines and more towards people living with rare diseases like myself, you mentioned earlier it's, you know, 1,700 miles from one part of the state to another. Outside of those major cities in Alaska, you know, how do Alaskans with serious conditions or rare diseases access specialty clinics or centers of excellence, either inside the state or if folks may need to even travel? How does your administration help folks sort of access that highly specialized care that they may need?
Well, we have a telehealth component, obviously, because of our distances and lack of roads. We have a well-defined airline system here in Alaska. There's more private airplane owners, air traffic, than probably anywhere else on the planet. We have a lot of jet service, 757s that can go to our smaller communities of 4,000 to 5,000 that have actual runways that can accommodate these jets. And so your center for really medical care is Anchorage, and to a lesser extent, Fairbanks, our two largest cities. And then down in Southeast Alaska, Juneau, but most of the folks in Southeast Alaska, when they seek specialty care, they'll fly to Seattle, which comparative to other parts of Alaska is closer for those folks to get care. And so Anchorage is the place. Providence Hospital, for example, there's a doc that does business there that deals with 50 to 70 CF patients throughout the state of Alaska. But obviously it's difficult. Obviously it's not ideal. We have about 730,000 people spread over 660,000 square miles. So it's a small population spread out over a subcontinent, makes things difficult. But once again, we have clinics in almost all of our villages. We do have a pretty good and growing telehealth approach to dealing with a lot of our health issues. And we do have a pretty well-defined air carrier system. Medevacs, folks getting on small planes, folks getting on larger planes, it's commonplace up here. And so again, it's not as robust as many other places in the United States just because of our small population. But as I mentioned, we do have about 50 to 70 CF patients. We do have a doc that's been here for a long time that deals with that particular issue. And they're located in Anchorage, Alaska.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the role of the interviewer will flip. Governor Dunleavy will ask the questions.
Where do you see things going from your perspective as a result of this pandemic? What do you see changing in terms of approaches to healthcare, especially dealing with issues such as CF and going into the future?
You know, I think one of the best things that happened to specialty care early in the pandemic was the telehealth waivers that were given to people living with cystic fibrosis and other medical conditions that would be able to benefit from it, simply because going to a hospital for someone with CF is a risk in and of itself, even outside of the pandemic, because of all the infection control that does go into CF care. And I do hope that moving forward, a lot of highly specialized conditions or chronic conditions aren't able to adopt some sort of telehealth regularity moving forward. And I think for me personally, I've been able to benefit from it. You know, I think having initially lived in New York and now live in New Hampshire, I think about as far away from you as possible as this podcast could ever be on the other side of the United States. But having lived in New York, I knew that going to a clinic day was essentially an entire day's worth of medical appointments. You know, it's a full, you know, 6-7-8 hour day. Whereas, you know, when I'm able to go on to telehealth, there's no commute, there's no parking that I have to pay for. There's no other tangentials that go along with care. And I think in a lot of ways, specialty clinics could probably learn a lot from rural states like Alaska or even Vermont or New Hampshire about delivering care in effective ways for people who do live outside of those metro areas.
Oh, that sounds good. You mentioned some barriers, but what other barriers do you see to care for folks?
So I almost look at living with a rare disease as almost like an unfair tax in the sense that we are paying for other parts of care that the general part of the population usually does not have to until later in life. And I think it's really important for me to impress upon policymakers like yourself and anyone sort of making decisions across the United States that there are financial tolls that we do have to account for, whether it's coming out of a hospital stay, a copay associated with a clinic visit. These are things that are essential parts of our lives and are so important for us to really be loud and proud about when we're talking with policymakers about what it's like to live with something like cystic fibrosis that is so intensive and something that just takes over our entire day after day after day. And I do appreciate, you know, you're willing to listening to me today. And of course, when other policymakers do listen to patient advocates, I think patient advocates are some of the best people around, and they're certainly not shy from asking for what they need to survive.
So you are a champion for folks that suffer from CF, obviously. And, you know, a lot of credit, obviously, to your folks that recognized early on that there needed to be individuals like yourself and your family that puts this on the radar screen for folks to actually pay attention to it. Because it is I think there's 30 to 50,000 right. Americans that suffer from CF. So it's a small population. It's a small patient population. What are the ways you feel the small populations of folks affected by issues such as that you're dealing with the CF, how can they be heard?
You know, I think one of the most effective ways that states are able to listen to rare disease folks is through the establishment of rare disease advisory councils so that there is a voice and there is a say at policy level decisions. And I think, I have to imagine you would agree that, you know, every single policy, you know, that is passed requires feedback and listening and input from every single stakeholder that can possibly give their feedback to understand how these things will either affect them positively or negatively. And more and more states are starting to get rare disease advisory councils. You know, I'm hoping Alaska's one of those states that institutes one in the near future. And I think it's something that's going to be something that I hope rather will be a norm across the country. And they are great conduits for folks like me living with cystic fibrosis or other rare conditions to get their voice heard when it really matters most.
So if you don't mind me asking one more question, yeah. Gunnar. So there was a new breakthrough, my understanding here recently on I don't know how you would word it, a drug cocktail, a drug therapy. Mm-hmm. And I forget how you pronounce it, starts with a T. How promising is this?
So yeah, you're talking about Trikafta. Trikafta is a three-component drug, and essentially it corrects the protein dysfunction at the heart of cystic fibrosis. I was fortunate enough to be one of the clinical trial participants, so I participated in the phase 3 clinical trial that started back in 2018, and the drug changed my life overnight. I was the kind of CF patient who was in and out of the hospital or on and off IV antibiotic therapy. Really every month, I would have 2 or 3 good weeks in a row, then I'd have 2 or 3 bad weeks in a row. And Trikafta essentially changed my life in the blink of an eye. In 2 or 3 days, my cough vanished. In a week, my pulmonary function skyrocketed. And I was suddenly gripped with the question of what do I do next now that I can breathe? And I sent myself off to grad school. I finished my MBA this past spring, and sort of now I'm looking down the road at the rest of my life, just got married. So things are definitely going pretty well in my life. But importantly, Trikafta was just approved for younger people living with cystic fibrosis. And I am so hopeful for that generation of people with CF, because I know they will live with a CF that is very different than the one that I grew up with. And that is really a testament to America's biomedical sector that is really pushing out amazing, amazing medications.
Well, I think it's also a testament to folks like you that have gotten so involved in it and have really pushed the issue. And I think there's one more issue involved with CF patients as well as other patients, and that's antibiotic resistance, the resistance to bacteria. And I know that you're also working on that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think one of the classic parts about cystic fibrosis is the respiratory disease that everyone sort of associates with CF. But really the meat and crux of that respiratory disease is the antibiotic resistance that you're talking about. You know, our infections are the kind of thing that usually make headlines when somebody acquires something like as serious as one of these in their own local communities. And these are, you know, bugs that we live with every single day. And as you pointed out, you know, as we expose more and more antibiotics to those bacteria, they evolve to be impervious to our drug arsenal. So I am a champion of the AMR issue, antimicrobial resistance issue, and we do need more antibiotics now more than ever. And I think we learned over the last year and a half what an infectious disease can do to a society. You know, no one wants any more shutdowns. I don't want any more shutdowns. I don't want any of that ever again. And I think it starts with investing in the right place.
No, it sounds great. Well, I appreciate the time. Is there any other question you want to throw my way?
I think we're great, Governor. This was fantastic. I appreciate your time and coming on the State of the Health.
Well, terrific. And I want to thank you again for your tireless efforts. Obviously, you were thrust into this, but nonetheless, you've taken this on. And you've become a champion for all of those suffering from CF and for those that have other chronic disease that don't necessarily have a big spotlight for folks to follow. But again, thank you for what you're doing.
I appreciate it. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah.
That's all for this week. Be sure to join us next week. New episodes come out every Wednesday morning, wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at G17Esiason, and you can check out my website at gunneresiason.com. If you liked what you heard today, be sure to subscribe to The State of Health and then leave a rating and a review. A big thank you to Governor Mike Dunleavy for today's interview. Also, a big thank you to Mary Vogt for her help with this week's show. The State of Health is produced by Bob Dwyer. Thanks to Odyssey for making this podcast possible. We'll see you next week.